and COVID-19, the science of climate, and we're seeing the defunding of research in this area. We're seeing researchers attacked and vilified and threatened because of the research that they do, because it's inconvenient, again, to certain ideological interests who want to see us double down on fossil fuels, or who have bought into the idea that, you know, vaccines are a dangerous conspiracy. In both cases, the consequences are deadly. People are losing their lives, and many more people will lose their lives if we continue down this current path of anti-science that we're going down here in the United States. It's a very dangerous time for all of us. And, you know, the irony here is that this is a country that was built on science and technology. And the wonders of, you know, modern life are due to the fact that this country valued scientists and it promoted and supported scientists for decades. And now, because certain areas of science have become inconvenient, again, to certain ideologically driven individuals and groups and industries, we find science under an attack. You know, again, there's almost no precedent. You have to go back to, you know, the early 1900s, Stalin's Russia, you know, the assault on scientists that happened then.
Michael Mann, we have to leave it there. I want to thank you for being with us from the University of Pennsylvania. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
I'm Molly, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
Be sure to tune in to Radio Lost and Found. It's the show that puts the OO in KBOO. Radio Lost and Found is a two-hour media escape of found sounds, forgotten records, outre recordings, and more. Coming to you every second and fourth Thursday from 10 to midnight, right here on KBOO.
And as they said, this is KBOO Portland. A little after 8 a.m. on a Tuesday morning. Coming up next is Too Much Information with your two hosts, Tracy Simmons and Abe Proctor. Please do stay tuned.
Good morning. Good morning, and welcome to Too Much Information on KBOO 90.7 FM. My name is Abe Proctor, and joining me, as she does each and every week, Tracy Simmons. Good morning, Tracy.
Good morning, Abe. Good morning, listeners.
Well, we're going to spend today talking about the set of decisions handed down last week by the Supreme Court of the United States, famously a bulwark of constitutional integrity and general small-r Republican good sense. The world appears much the same this morning, Tracy, except for the fact that you and I and everybody else might not actually be citizens of the United States. What's that all about?
Yeah, we are in the upside down, it feels like. You know, our Supreme Court is there, supposedly, and I'm just going to say supposedly because I know historically we've been on the wrong side of history many times. And they are, once again, a bought and sold Supreme Court is what we're dealing with right now. But they just allowed, you know, for the current president to trample over the Constitution. And the whole idea of the Supreme Court is to protect the Constitution, the foundation of, you know, what we say the laws of this country are. And now they have dismantled part of the Constitution, which is the 14th Amendment, which says that people born in this country are citizens of the country. And so my question for everyone today is, if you're not a citizen by birthright of this country, what makes you a citizen? Who is a citizen? And who is safe now from, you know, of course, no due process and getting scooped up off the streets by ICE? I mean, that really is the conversation that we should be having. And also, what does it mean to have a Supreme Court that consistently undermines the Constitution of this country for the purpose of, you know, forwarding the aims of the very far right.
Yes, those are absolutely questions should be we should be asking in conversations that we should be having. 503-231-8187. You've described a situation, Tracy, that is, I think it's confusing on the surface and in the near term, and in the medium and long terms could pose untold difficulties in terms of sorting out whether or not the president's campaign to ethnically purge, ethnically cleanse the United States of people whose skin tone is perhaps a shade or too dark for his preference, or whose ideological preferences fall outside of those he considers acceptable. It's hard to say how that's going to shake out over time, but I think in the near term, the decision obfuscates the situation enough so that the president's mass deportation campaign, the one that you just described about being plucked off the streets by ICE, will be able to continue unabated. And I think in the end, that is enough for the president. And we were a little cheeky at the beginning, suggesting that, you know, all of us might not be citizens. I don't think that's what this ruling means. And we're going to get into that in a little more detail here. But what it does mean is that for the foreseeable future, the president is going to be able to continue to kidnap people off the streets, render them to a Central American gulag, and the federal court system is going to have little to no power to check him in this. So in this regard, the Supreme Court's decision on birthright citizenship, such as it is, has enabled a rogue presidency to continue its abuse of the Constitution, of its legal authority, and of the rights of people of the United States, including natural-born citizens of the United States.
And where is due process in all of this? Right, because it's also part of the Constitution that people have the right to due process. So there's no due process. We're also, you know, butting up against cruel and unusual punishment to send people out of the country, far away from any loved ones or anyone to check on them and take care of, like, what's going on with their legal situation. This is, if anyone is still questioning whether or not we are on the downward slide to the worst form of fascism in this country, I'm sorry, I don't know what to tell you.
Well, let's look at this decision in a little more detail, and perhaps then folks will have a better idea of the sort of ambiguity that we're trying to describe, which might be a fool's errand in and of itself. How does one describe ambiguity? Well, we're going to try this morning. So here's what the decision says. So far, there have been three federal courts in various districts around the country that have issued injunctions barring the executive branch's actions as it pertains to the notion of birthright citizenship. And just to reiterate, in case there's any doubt out there, birthright citizenship is enshrined in the Constitution in the 14th Amendment when it extends citizenship to all persons born in the United States. All persons born in the United States. This ruling was a landmark in our history for a number of reasons, not the least of which was that it was part of the set of post-Civil War amendments that forever granted the protections of citizenship and of the law to formerly enslaved persons here in the United States. Now, that history, as you know, played out in quite a different manner than the verbiage of the 14th Amendment might suggest. But nevertheless, the 14th and its fellow post-war amendments established this really beyond the shadow of a doubt. It's unlikely that you're ever going to find constitutional language that is less ambiguous, than all persons born in the United States are citizens. So what the decision by the Supreme Court did, it didn't rule on the substance of birthright citizenship, because as I just described, that is pretty clear cut. What it did instead, and this is where it gets either interesting or disgusting or convoluted depending on your perspective, what it did is say that the lower federal courts, the federal district courts, the courts of appeals, and so on, do not have the power to issue nationwide injunctions against actions of the executive branch. So even though they are federal courts, and in theory should rule on matters pertaining to all citizens of the United States, lower courts can no longer issue these injunctions to stop a rogue executive branch like the one that is in office now. What it can do is provide immediate relief to plaintiffs. So if you're somebody who is facing imminent deportation / rendition because you were born here in the United States to parents who were here without documentation, you might be granted immediate relief in your case, meaning recognition of the fact that you yourself are a citizen. But the lower courts no longer have the power to make these decisions apply to everyone, which means that every single case of an American citizen facing imminent rendition by this administration must litigate their case in court if they are to have a hope of avoiding the fate of being sent off to a prison in El Salvador whose owners claim that nobody ever leaves. That's what we're talking about. And it gets even crazier, Tracy, because in issuing its majority opinion, the court said that these powers, meaning the ability to grant nationwide injunctions by the federal courts, were not envisioned by the Constitution. So therefore, they should not be able to do it. The ability to issue a ruling that applies universally in all parts of the country to every U.S. citizen, that is the sole province now of the Supreme Court. Other federal courts can't do it. And here is the supreme capping irony of this whole business. In attempting to revert to a form of originalism, saying the lower courts can't do this thing, the Supreme Court has opened the doors for an executive branch that is day by day hollowing out the Constitution, eviscerating checks on its power. So in the name of adherence and loyalty to the Constitution in terms of the judiciary, the Supreme Court is granting free rein to a would-be fascist in the White House. It's a horrible decision, Tracy.
Yeah, a terrible decision. And once again, right, all of this was written out. This was all written down in Project 2025. It was described quite well that this usurping of powers and really consolidating powers of the presidency and with his, you know, cronies there in the Supreme Court, which, of course, you know, we know some of them got there through bribery and through backroom deals, because that is how the current president operates and always. These people are now beholden to him, and they're going to continue giving him power until it's too late. And I think it's too late already. And so this is the question, right? Like, what do we do in the moment? What do we do right now? I hear all the time on this program people calling in to say, you know, we should be, you know, getting a third party, or getting rid of the Democrats, or, you know, I don't know that any of that is going to suffice at this moment. Like, what do we do right now with a rogue Supreme Court that has been bought and sold by the Trump administration and Trump, who continues to use them as a tool to gain more and more power and use that power against the American people? And when I asked the question about, well, if no one is a citizen by birthright, who is a citizen? I'm not saying that in jest. I'm saying that to say it's not somebody else's problem right now. It's all of our problem. And when I think about my ancestry as a, you know, an ancestor of former enslaved people, what does that mean for Black people? What does that mean for pretty much anyone, right? Because none of us, you know, are originally from here.
No.
So I don't know. It's befuddling, but also very easily predictable. This is what we were told would happen. And at some point, right, we are going to have to activate as a nation to say enough. And I don't know what that looks like. I don't know that people are mobilizing for that. You know, I know that there are demonstrations planned for July 4th. I know there have been mass demonstrations. Is that enough in this moment of a dictatorship really forming? Is that enough?
It's hard to say. It's hard to say. We went through the month of June, and we were talking about these lower court injunctions right now that have helped to stay the president's hand as he attempts to ethnically cleanse the United States. Throughout the month of June, we had it was something in the mid-90% of court decisions, all of them went against the Trump administration last month. now we're looking at a situation where those lower federal courts are no longer going to be able to do that. They're no longer going to be able to stay in hand. So what this means, I think, in the shorter term, with regard to the president's deportation campaign, is he's essentially going to be able to act with impunity. And I think we're going to see the volume of deportations and renditions increase. We're going to see the pace increase if this absurd bill that is before Congress right now is passed into law. We're going to see enormous amounts of resources dedicated to growing this program even more. So it appears that the president is going to use this period of time, which we can call what, constitutionally ambiguous, legally fraught, I don't know, however you want to describe it. They're going to use this period to ship out as many brown people as they possibly can. And that's very blunt language, but that's exactly what's going to happen.
It is. And I feel like, you know, I'm in this interesting milieu of people who will say, you know, black people, we showed up, we voted for Kamala in large numbers. Like, this isn't our problem anymore. This is y'all. No, actually, right now, Trump is working to establish a deportation plan for Haitians. And I don't know how people think they're going to be able to tell a Haitian person from me, because we look alike. I'm sorry. it's not that hard. I mean, so it's like, no, it is all of our problem. Let's get activated. It's all of our problem. And I feel like this way that the current administration has helped to divide people in ways to section off people. Well, I'm not an immigrant, or, oh, well, you know, I actually I'm a citizen, right? I don't know how you're going to be able to tell the difference. And we've already seen people who are citizens being treated in the same exact way as people who are, quote unquote, here illegally, right? Like, that is the narrative. And so I don't know how people feel like they're going to be distinguished from somebody else for saying the wrong thing, for thinking the wrong thing, for showing up at that protest and saying the wrong thing. I really worry that people are not prepared.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's just the thing about this ruling. It makes those distinctions meaningless, right? The government doesn't need to wait now to figure out if you are, in fact, an American citizen. They can round you up and they can ship you off. And witness how hard the administration has fought to keep those people that they mistakenly rendered to El Salvador. Look how hard they've worked to keep those people there. Why? Because they wanted to establish and maintain the precedent that they have the power and the authority to do that. And this decision from the Supreme Court really, really strengthens their hand, because they really don't have to wait around the niceties, around the sorts of distinctions as you were just talking about, Tracy. They can do whatever they want. And this is looming large, I think, in the minds of the justices who dissented from this decision. And we should note that this was a 6-3 decision that played out very, quite predictably along ideological lines. Here's Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson writing in her dissent, quote, "Perhaps the degradation of our rule of law regime would happen anyway, but this court's complicity in the creation of a culture of disdain for lower courts, their rulings, and the law as they interpret it, will surely hasten the downfall of our governing institutions, enabling our collective demise." So, Tracy, you are not alone in sensing that this is now everybody's problem. And if birthright citizenship is no longer a governing factor in who ICE can and cannot snatch off the streets and ship out of the country, then this is everybody's problem. Is the number to call. Looks like we're experiencing a slight technical problem. We're going to take a short time out and we'll be back at you. Hang on. We'll be right back.
Well, are we back?
Good morning, maybe. Kids. You're live.
All right. We are back. Apologies for that brief interruption. We are working on getting this sorted out, I promise you. 503-231-8187 is our call. Tracy, before we were unceremoniously cut off, I was reading a quote from Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson's dissent. I'm going to read that again because I think it's a good segue to the next part of our conversation. Here's what she said in her dissent. Perhaps the degradation of our rule of law regime would happen anyway, but this court's complicity in the creation of a culture of disdain for lower courts, their rulings, and the law as they interpret it will surely hasten the downfall of our governing institution, enabling our collective demise. That's the kind of language you don't often hear in a Supreme Court ruling.
I think the gravity of the situation requires such language. And unfortunately, it's just language, because she's just one of the nine. And she's watching her peers go about this in a way that I'm sure is offensive. As also a person who's a descendant of enslaved Africans in America, to see us dismantle parts of the Constitution that were created specifically for the protection of my ancestors, right? Like I can't imagine you're watching that. And of course, you know, knowing what we know about fascist movements and dictatorships and how they use the rule of law to harm certain individuals, right? And knowing that the certain individuals that have historically been harmed by the Supreme Court, whether we're talking about the Dred Scott case, where we said, you know, sorry, black people aren't humans and they don't get any rights, right? Like all of that, right, added up over time is why Ketanji Brown Jackson sits on that court, right? To uphold the laws that have been created in the vision of a freer America, of a liberated America, right? We'll never get that way, this, you know, in the direction that we're going right now with this current Supreme Court. And I'm just sick. To watch your peers go along and bit by bit dismantle parts of the Constitution that make us weaker as a country, that undermine the people that parts of that Constitution were put in place to protect and to honor. I can't imagine what she feels, you know, going to work with these people every day. I just can't imagine sitting in that lion's den.
Yeah. Yeah. It's safe to say that they're not all having lunch together. 503-231 8187 is the number to call. Really interested to hear what people are thinking about this. There's another angle of this, Tracy, that I think we have to mention, and it hits the same old refrain that we always seem to hit when we're talking about decisions in this sort of vein, and that is that, of course, the burden of this is now going to fall on individual plaintiffs who now have to litigate in court the fact that they are, in fact, American citizens. And let's be quite frank about this. This means that a lot of people who really can't afford protracted litigation on something like this or on anything are going to have to pony up the resources simply to establish the fact that they are citizens and have a right to be here. It's nonsense. And really, you know, I doubt that the government is going to take any steps to make those people whole if they challenge a deportation and happen to win based on the fact that they're, you know, a citizen. I don't think that sort of remuneration is going to be forthcoming.
Yeah, absolutely not. And once again, right, when we think about, you know, challenging the federal government at the level that it's at right now with regard to, you know, fast moving towards fascism and extreme fascism, not just, you know, regular fascism, right, that we've been on for about 30, 40 years, you know, we're at the extreme end of that, right? And to think that a person is going to have the resources to challenge that is actually laughable. And also, I want people to really think, if you had to defend yourself as a citizen of this country, what would that look like? What would that be? Has anyone ever been brought to court? Have you ever had to fight against the federal government? I mean, the level of resources that you are facing just to say I deserve to be here, that
bar is so high, most people would not have the resources or the ability. And so I want us to be moving away from thinking about those people. So what if it was you? Because it might be. It might be someday.
And I think you've hit on a key question there. And Engineer Sonia just asked us the same question in the chat. She says, how do you defend yourself? What are the criteria? How can you prove any of these things? That is a very, very good question. And it's one that was essentially dodged by the court in this decision. As we mentioned at the top, they did not go after the notion of birthright citizenship itself, although one has the sense that they would like to. Instead, they went after the power of lower courts to stand in the way of the administration as it is purging the country of people it doesn't like, whether or not they happen to be birthright citizens. And there have been a number of opinions from constitutional law scholars out there in the wake of this decision that suggest that birthright citizenship itself is unlikely to come under direct assault. It's pretty clear-cut what the 14th Amendment says. Instead, we're going to see what we spent this show predicting will happen, meaning that people will be rounded up wholesale, whether or not they are American citizens, and shipped off, and it will be left to each individual in each individual case to litigate their rights as citizens. So it essentially gives a free hand to the president to carry out his deportation / rendition campaign, letting the chips fall where they may and putting the onus on individuals to prove that they in fact are citizens and have a right to be here. It's a horrific decision that hands the power to a rogue executive, allows the executive branch to exceed the boundaries of its own constitutional authority while shying away from the actual meat of the question at hand, and doing so on the grounds that they, the Supreme Court, are staunch traditionalists. It's just, you know, how many knots can they tie themselves into in pursuit of their racist and their fascistic agenda?
Yeah. I mean, they've been paid. They've been bought and paid. And you know, at this point, they are a tool. They are an arm of that rogue administration. And so for anyone thinking that they are going to stand in the gap for the rest of us, I've got news. It's not happening. Should we go to the phones, Abe?
Yes. Let's go to Santiago. Good morning.
Good morning. You know, to address the two questions you posed at the beginning of the show, who is a citizen? White people are citizens. Always have been, always will be, regardless of their status, for the most part. Cis, especially cis, white, heterosexual males, always citizens. That's who has always been a citizen. If you haven't had to fight for your right to be recognized as a human being, you are in fact a citizen of the United States, because that's who the U.S., regardless of its standpoint at any point in history, has always regarded as citizens. I'm a citizen on paper, but I've never been treated as a citizen and in part or in whole. And, you know, and many of my people, I mean, I might get away with a lot. I might not be as recognized. I might be more recognized because my skin is lighter and I don't have an accent, but I was called all sorts of horrible names before I even knew what they were just for existing. So to answer your question, white people are citizens. And then second, what do we do? I don't know. There may be not a whole lot we can do in this moment, to be honest, because this has been, it's like we've been watching a wind-up punch that's taken 50 years, and the people who have had the ability to oppose it have not, because it's bad for business to oppose it. Like, we've seen this wind-up punch. You know, I mean, I know you guys get frustrated when I say it's the Democrats, but the Democrats have been the only actual supposed opposition, and this has been a wind-up punch. Like, they've been leaning back. We've seen the fist. We've talked about it, but talking about the fist is bad for business because, you know, you can't call them racist. They just, you know, they just want states' rights, you know? you can't call them racist. It's like, we just have a culture of just whatever's good for business is okay, even if it's not okay. And so So we've had a 50-year wind-up punch we've seen coming. There may be no defense for it now, because even the opposition has been the supposed opposition has been a part of dismantling the actual defense we would have against something like this, which is, you know, leftist organizing. Everything, even stuff as meek as reformism with a capitalist lens, has been dismantled under the auspices of being communist or socialist. So, I mean, in my summation, in our communities, we could probably do some organizing to mitigate some of the damage, but ultimately we have to look long-term. What is the long-term plan? I keep saying it, we need to get out of this two-party system idea, and we need to start organizing on terms of like human rights, because clearly the Democratic Party is unable or unwilling to defend its constituents. We might have a few people who are speaking out, but that doesn't speak for the whole of the party. The whole of the party of the whole of the party leadership and the party of Democratic Party leadership and Republican Party leadership are in lockstep. You know, they're upset about the same things. You know, they might go about it a different way, but at the end of the day, it's like, it's just, it's been bad. They're all about what's good for business. So we have to get away from that, you know? So that means, you know, going to organize with parties that whose politics don't revolve around electoralism, you know, anti-capitalism, anti-colonial, you know, anti-white supremacy, you know, people who understand that we're dealing with feral animals who without proper supervision will eat us. And we have to approach all of them with that same sort of understanding. And we're not going to get that from the people who mean to eat us. You know, Malcolm X said it the best. You know, he talked about, you know, the difference between the wolf and the fox. You know, everybody's scared of the wolf because you can see the wolf coming, you know what he's up to, but the fox is, the fox can form its teeth into the shape of a smile so that you can mistake it for a friend, but they're both predators in the forest. And I keep saying too, we're here because white people haven't been sufficiently affected by what's been going on until now. You know, if white people actually saw white supremacy as a white people problem, they wouldn't have just been like trying to be allies to black people for 50 years. Or if they saw, you know, queer liberation as a problem for the whole of humanity, they wouldn't be out here just trying to be allies. They would actually see it as a problem they need to fix. And I mean, in a lot of ways, it might be a little too late to mitigate the most damage we could do. But it is what it is. I say that as somebody who could be a potential victim. You know, I mean, I could definitely die here pretty soon if things don't shape up. But that doesn't change the fact that, you know, as individuals, we need to look seven generations into the future in a way that doesn't center us. What does that look like?
That's a really great question. And thank you once again for an outstanding phone call. We really appreciate your contribution to the show. What's your response to Santiago's comments, Tracy?
I mean, Santiago said no lies. What's interesting right now within the Democratic Party, they, you know, it's like, you know, saying like they're fighting with the Republicans, but actually they're punching each other. So we're talking about, you know, getting rid of David Hogg out of the party leadership. A young person who came with young energy, who was part of the, you know, Parkland shooting, and, you know, brought some really good young energy, and continually is being punched by the 7-year-olds who want to maintain the party control, right? We saw that in, you know, races within the party. You know, right now, Zohan Mamdani is being slandered from every, and that is the primary winner out of New York for mayor, a Democratic Party winner, a very progressive person of color, Muslim, being demonized, right? And actually has the potential of winning the mayorship of New York. Just, I mean, slaughtered, the Cuomos, right? Like in this race, and still the Democratic Party is punching sideways at each other, and it's like, what? I wish you had the same energy for Trump and his cronies. I wish you had the same energy for the Republican Party, who continue to strip us of our rights. And so, I mean, yes, Santiago told no lies, and once again, right, we have, because we have this very polarized nation, and then we only have two choices that have been put in front of us over and over again, and both of those factions are trying to stop things like ranked choice voting and moving us closer towards having more choices, because they know that they benefit from the power that they maintain. And at the same time, what is happening in the background and the foreground is Donald Trump is using this opportunity to continue stripping us of any successful attempts towards liberation of us all.
Yes. And I think we need to acknowledge something at this point. Really, I think this could be subtext for probably 90% of the conversations that we have on this program. And that is the simple fact that white supremacists in this country have never been able to let go. They have never been able to accept defeat. They have never been able to accept setbacks. They have never been able to let go. They are like a dog with a bone. Let's talk about the notion of birthright citizenship itself. It's from the 14th Amendment, which we were talking about earlier in the program. This was passed by Congress during the Civil War. So at this point, there are no Confederate states that have representation in the United States federal government. So this is just the North. This is just the North who drafted and passed this amendment in Congress. And the amendment was then, according to the Constitution, passed on to the many states for ratification. It takes the approval of 3/4 of the states to make an amendment part of the Constitution. So this ratification process took part after the war was over, during the during Reconstruction, and it was ratified by 3/4 of state legislatures, almost entirely because of the way that those state governments were constituted during Reconstruction. For the first time in history, we had African American representatives, not just in Congress, but in state legislatures. So not for the fact that newly freed enslaved people, granted citizenship by the post-war amendments, were able to legislate in their state legislatures for ratification of this amendment. Without that, this would never have come to pass. So despite all of this, despite the fact that it was an amendment introduced in the right way, ratified by the states in the right way and in the right numbers, white supremacists have never, ever been able to let go of this. And they even challenged it on the basis that, well, when it was drafted by Congress, the southern states weren't part of the process. Well, they were part of the process because they were in open armed rebellion against the federal government. And then they further have complained that, well, it only was ratified because of all the black people who were in state legislatures. Yes. Well, yes. When formerly enslaved people are allowed to function as full human beings, the outcome might not be to the preference of white supremacists. But at this stage, and at every stage since then, they have never, ever been able to let go of this cause. They have never, ever been able to step back from their belief that they are the only true inheritors of America and of Americanism. They are the real Americans. Everybody else is suspect. Everybody else who was born here, even though the Constitution explicitly says that they too are citizens. They have never given up on this. They are never going to stop. Donald Trump is their avatar, and they are devoted to him because finally he has openly acknowledged this secret desire that they have carried deep in their hearts for generations now. And it's never going to go away, Tracy. At the end of the day, I don't know what we do about that. I hate that will never go away.
I mean, I've said this, I think, on this program before, but the reason white supremacy exists, and I don't mean it just at the individual level, right? Like, racism is happening on multiple different levels all at the same time. At that like base level, the intrapersonal, what's inside of me, for people who hold those beliefs,
That identity is a primary identity. It means I get certain kinds of privileges, and I am, by default, better than other kinds of people, right? So I don't know that anyone would give that up if they felt that way deeply in their spirit, right? That I am, just by virtue of my skin color and my heritage, a better person than someone else. So there's that, right? Then there's the interpersonal, right? How do I exist in relationship to other people with that ideology? Well, that means I treat other people less than me, and I expect them to treat me as the venerated person, the better human that I am, right? So there's that. Then there's full institutions, where institutional policies, institutional practices, institutional ideologies are also spreading this kind of idea of a certain kind of person being better than others. And it plays out in the institutional outcomes. It plays out in how those institutions operate, how they fund themselves or how they get funded, right? And then we have the whole systems, right? When we have multiple institutions that are all doing that at the same time. So white supremacy is way beyond the individual person. But I will tell you, it can never be dismantled unless individual people give up that ideology that somehow, because of the virtue of their skin color and birth, that they are better than others. And that is something that, I'm sorry, a lot of people can't even acknowledge is true for them, especially out loud. And so it can't be given up, because you can't change what you don't acknowledge. And so these are the larger implications of society that never, right, held people accountable after 1865, right? And I say 1865 because that was the end of the, you know, of the war. We just celebrated Juneteenth, of course, right, at the end of slavery for people who had been enslaved 2 years past the time, right? So, I mean, these are deeply held beliefs of people, and it requires giving up that ideology, and that's where the rubber hits the road. But that's where we also see consistent resistance. You know, in pardoning the January Sixers, right? We also saw similar to the lost cause kind of fervor, people who had done something they thought was patriotic to take back the country from who? Joe Biden, another white person? What are you talking about? First off, but second, right? They saw themselves as doing something, venerating their cause, and they were basically given a slap on the wrist, and now they're being given money. They are being paid reparations for going to jail and being imprisoned and fined and all of those things. What and what world? In a white supremacist world. And until we can get a clear reckoning of that, and for people who have those beliefs to really sit with that, we'll never be able to change it. I'm sorry.
I just can't get my head around it. I've thought about this literally for years now. I mean, the amount of effort it takes to fan this hatred, to keep it going, to hold it close, to hand it down from one generation to the next, holding out against the hopes one day that somehow it'll be able to burst into flame again openly, and you'll be able to finally purge the country of all these people who don't deserve to be. That's exhausting. How do you move through life like that? I don't understand it. Isn't it so much easier and nicer to move through the world with arms open, with heart open, with love for all of your fellow human beings? Hate is exhausting. I don't understand it, and I don't think I will ever understand it. 503-231-8187. Let's go to Luther Meyer. Good morning.
Good morning. First off, I'd like to thank you for fact-checking that Iran history last week.
Sure.
That was good to hear. What I'm calling about is the 14th Amendment. No, that clause about except for those that are not under the jurisdiction of the United States laws, that, for me, that applies to diplomats. And I think that was the carve-out.
That diplomats being part of their nation's envoys are sort of exist in this extra national space?
Yeah, they're not under the jurisdiction of U.S. laws.
Okay. And that was the sole carve-out for the 14th Amendment?
I think that's what that clause is about.
Hmm. How is that relevant to what we're talking about?
That's the people that are not, that don't have birthright citizenship.
Oh, okay. Okay.
People.
Oh, okay. So, all right. So you're the ambassador from Norway, and you're here, and you have a kid. They are not necessarily birthright citizen.
Right.
Okay, I gotcha.
So I think, you know, I think what they're trying to do is find some reason to use that clause to eliminate other people.
Oh, okay. Okay. You know, I wouldn't put it past them. I wouldn't put it past them, especially given the latitude that this administration is was just granted by the Supreme Court of the United States.
Yes. Now, a few weeks ago, I read the 14th Amendment in the Britannica, and at the end of the article, there was the original 14th Amendment. It got changed.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember exactly what it was, but I thought it was very interesting to read the original. So you might want to check that out.
How did it differ from what we all know as the 14th Amendment today?
I don't recall, and I'm blind, so I can't look it up right now.
Well, that's, I'm really intrigued. I think that's something I'm going to have to follow up on after the program.
Yeah, that's what I suggest you do. Anyway, thanks a lot.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Hey, thanks very much for the call.
I'm definitely going to look into it.
yes, most definitely. Go ahead, Drake.
I wanted to report good news in all of this. Looks like Trump is telling reporters that he'll take a look, that's in your quotes, at reporting Elon Musk on the heels of the billionaire's ongoing criticism. So, of course, Elon Musk has threatened funding a primary challenge to the people who support Donald Trump's Big Beautiful Bill. He has taken a nod at, using his mass of wealth to form a non-Democrat, non-Republican party, so forming a third party, a real threat to Trump. Trump does not like to be criticized in any way. And now he's, falling out with his bestie boo. He's talking about, doing the right thing and getting rid of the people who really shouldn't be here as opposed to the hardworking people they're scooping up from their jobs and at places of work and schools and graduations. I don't know. We got to have levity somewhere. It all feels so heavy.
Yeah. Musk is a naturalized citizen, but as Utamar just suggested, that's probably a distinction that's not going to stop the Trump administration when it wants to get rid of somebody. But, Elon's one of those people who does have the resources to litigate his individual case in court. So I have a feeling that Elon will not be so easily gotten rid of. And certainly we don't want to send him back to South Africa where there's a genocide going on against white people. We don't want to do that.
Please.
503-231-8187 is the number to call. So we've been tossing around, Tracy, this idea of what do we do? What do we do about all this? And I think the answer, as it has been to similar questions we've posed on this program, is the creation of community webs of support, right? If somebody who's a naturalized citizen is being faced with imminent deportation or rendition, I think communities are going to have to come together to support those folks, particularly if they come from the lower rungs of the socioeconomic ladder. It's going to be community resources that are going to have to come to the aid of members of the community. Yet again.
Yeah, I've been saying this for a while. I know other folks who've called in to watch. He's a big supporter of this. But what are our mutual aid funds? How do we show up for each other in these moments? I say it a million times, but then they came for
poem is not long. We are halfway through it at this point. So, you know, if we're waiting for, you know, someone to stand up for us in the moment where we should be standing for someone else, I promise you, right now is the time. So what are those networks of community that we have that we can connect with? What are the resources and how do we pool those resources in support for and in defense of our neighbors and community members and people we care deeply for? That it doesn't have to be us. It doesn't even have to be someone you know. But just know you're next. If not now, you're next. And so for me, it's, you know, how do we engage in ways that are subversive of this current administration, but also planning for what do we do next? Because if y'all are waiting for, you know, the 2028 election, I promise you, that's a far off a far off goal. We need to be thinking about the here and the now. How do we, you know, pool our resources, have back channels of communication? How do we show up? And we talked about this a couple weeks ago, Abe, but, you know, people just showing up in their community where ICE were showing up. And if mm-hmm. you are a safe person, mm-hmm. a person who ICE is not targeting, that is your work right now, right? If you know that ICE is gathering up people down the street from you, show up there. Start shouting them down. Do yes. what you can. And, you know, I've been lucky so far that I haven't seen ICE in the communities that I am engaging in on a regular basis. I think they know they're probably not safe there. And there's a reason they don't feel safe there. So let's yeah. do our due diligence. And knowing that it's not just for the person that is being attacked right now, but that you're next.
Yeah. Yeah, right, exactly. Each of us carries in our pocket the means to document and send to the entire world you know, incidents of ICE transgressing the bounds of not just the law, but of moral decency. We all have that power now. I mean, imagine somebody in your community, a kid whose parents were undocumented but born here, a citizen, and ICE comes for them. ICE comes for the whole family. Well, it's one thing if those ICE agents are allowed to do their business you know, without the lens of public opinion focused at them, in the dark, essentially. And quite another, if in order to get to their target, they've got to force their way through a line of people who are out there shouting, no, you cannot do this. And while the whole thing is being filmed and transmitted live to the entire world, this is the power to sway public opinion that the communication age has afforded to all of us. So when we're talking about building, you know, networks of community support, this is part of it too. Outing these people when they're doing the nefarious work of the administration, all of this needs to be hauled out into the full light of day whenever it's possible, at every opportunity.
So, I mean, and I wonder, right? Because in this, and I think Unter Hauer said this, like, they didn't really address anything to do with birthright citizenship. What they have done is hamstrung the lower court from being able to stop Trump in his tracks, right? So I'm wondering what is the larger conversation there? Because obviously they're stopping the lower courts from, you know, intervening in Trump's behaviors, but they are on its face not doing anything about the larger issue at hand. I think it's purposeful. It feels purposeful because they know that if they were to, as a court, have some kind of stance on birthright citizenship, they would be in violation of their oath to defend the Constitution.
You know, that violating that oath hasn't seemed to mean a whole lot to quite a few people of late, unfortunately. And we should also, along the lines of your question there, I've read some commentary from constitutional scholars that this Supreme Court decision does allow for states to act as plaintiffs in these cases, and that lower courts can, on behalf of plaintiffs who happen to be states, can issue these sorts of universal injunctions. So if, for example, the state of Oregon decides to take up a case and challenge the actions of ICE as it pertains to the attempted deportation of a naturalized, of a birthright citizen, they can manage to get an injunction handed down by a lower court if they act as a state. So you can easily see this falling out along, well, along geographic lines, right? It's not every state is going to take up this cause. It's not every state is going to attempt to get such an injunction handed down from a lower court. So basically, you're going to have the country segregated by ideology, and meaning that even more so than right now, certain parts of the country are going to be safer for potential targets of illegal rendition or deportation than other parts of the country are. So, yeah, if you happen to be listening, state legislature, it's time to take up this cause and get an injunction for the state of Oregon.
I mean, I think so. And like, who is going to support that? Is it going to be the Attorney General? Like, who is it?
Yeah, it would. I guess it would be. It would be the Attorney General here in Oregon from the State Department of Justice, acting as a plaintiff on behalf of citizens in the state of Oregon who are being illegally deported. It's. I don't think it's that big of a reach. But like I said, the only problem is Oregon. It's not the entire country. But of course, you know, we must be loyal to the Constitution, which means giving a rogue president the latitude to do whatever the hell he wants to do. Okay, I think we have one more phone call here before the end. Let's go to BT. Good morning.
Yes, good morning, Abe.
Are you
Tracy.
With us? Oh, good morning.
Yes, do you... the previous caller already pointed out some of the stuff about the carve out. Children of diplomats. There's actually more than that. There's actually a list. Of course, it doesn't really say that in the 14th Amendment. So therefore, shouldn't go around saying that. You know, it's perfectly clear because it says under the jurisdiction of. I don't even know what that means. I asked a judge, a friend of mine, what that means. He didn't know in terms of how you could apply it. But, for instance, the children of soldiers in an invading army occupying part of the U.S., they would not be counted as citizens, I guess, unless their mother is an American taking up with him. But there's a list. I looked it up online. But... like I said, that's the whole point there. Under the jurisdiction of, I think the courts have approved the list. I think that has to be put in by the Congress. So it's not just a blanket, you're born here, you're in. Even though it says that, it doesn't mean it because of the under the jurisdiction of, and it was dealt with, I guess, with a list by Congress. So I just wanted to point that out. And this Supreme Court ruling from last week did not say that you're not a citizen. It was because this, you know, an executive order can't do that. I think they made it clear that they weren't really ruling on that because it can't be done. I would say that if anyone wants to change it will have to be an amendment adding to it.
Right. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you very much for the call. Again, I am not a constitutional scholar, but the language of the 14th Amendment seems pretty unambiguous to me. The jurisdictions of the United States, I mean, that's federal law, that's state law, that's county and municipal law. Those are the jurisdictions of the United States. That encompasses virtually everybody. I'm sure if you get down to a really granular level, you're going to perhaps find some people like the children of diplomats for whom the 14th Amendment does not apply. But I think in terms of how we live our everyday lives and the way that this ruling is going to be applied, that means just about everybody. So that brings us to the end of the program, Tracy. Do you have any words of wisdom to send us home?
Well, yes. NPR is tracking a class action lawsuit filed on behalf of two immigrant rights organizations. And we will be kind of following that case and giving you an update on what's happening there. I'm hoping that Oregon signs on to the class action lawsuit and that it becomes something that is so big the federal government does not have the ability to push back on it. But it's also really hot, so please take care of your neighbors and yourselves. If you have the elders and unsheltered folks in your neighborhood, please check in and make sure that you are being a good neighbor to folks who might not have the shelter to keep cool right now.
And we'll leave it there. Thank you to everybody who took part in the conversation today. Thank you for tuning in and supporting this program. You can support this radio station by going to kboo.fm and clicking on the donate button. We need your support to stay on the air now more than ever. This has been Too Much Information on KBOO 90.7 FM.
Over me. You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Hi, this is Cecil Prescott. Celeste Carey and I are the co-hosts for More Talk Radio, which airs on KBOO FM 90.7 on Mondays at 8 a.m. For 30